Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Zayin Amud Aleph, six lines down. Amar Rav Papa, Hayarita Didlai, this water channel that is drawn with buckets, Einot Limi Menu Liyadayim, one cannot use that for Netilat Yadayim. Delo Atu Mikoach Gavra, because here there's a failure in the fact that we don't have something that is deriving from the action of an individual. Ve'i Mikarev Ligabe Davlo, if the individual gets closer to where the bucket is pouring in, where there you are then the recipient of the input of the individual who's pouring, then you can't use that for netilat yadayim. So as Rashi explains over here, the arita didalai is a water channel, or basically an irrigation ditch that is filled by the rivers that go by. But the rivers don't directly go into this irrigation ditch. You need to draw the water from the river and then fill the irrigation ditch. And as Tosafot points out, that's the meaning here of Arita Didalai. Arita means the river, and then Didalai means a bucket that you draw with. So it's not a description of the irrigation ditch, but rather the mechanism by which you fill the irrigation ditch. Had it been that the river flowed into the irrigation ditch, the din might have been totally different, as we'll see in a second. But over here, since you're filling the irrigation ditch with the bucket of water, then the water that's flowing through there is coming from koach gavra, because the person's pouring the water from the bucket. But as we learned earlier in the Masechta, back on daf tet zayin amud aleph, with regards to koach adam or koach gavra, that only has implications when you are close to where the individual is doing the action. Once you move yourself a distance from where the action is taking place, or there's some delay between the action and your receiving or being affected by that action, that's already considered to be koach sheni, and therefore it's not a direct koach gavra. And over here, there is a requirement, we'll see in a second, the Baalei Tosafot modified it slightly, of koach gavra, that one must pour the water on their hands in order for it to be netilat yadayim. You can't simply put your hands into the water. So here we have water flowing down the irrigation ditch. If you were to put your hands into the ditch itself, that would not suffice in terms of netilat yadayim, because you have two failures over here. The first failure is the fact that you don't have koach gavra, because when you put them into the ditch, you're far away from where the water was poured into the ditch. And since there is distance and delay between where the water was poured into the ditch and where your hands are getting washed by the water in the irrigation ditch, it's no longer considered to be koach gavra, and that's a failing and won't suffice for netilat yadayim. Now, the other option, which we've seen until now, is that you could dip your hands into the irrigation ditch and do tevilat yadayim, and then you would be yotze with, rather than netilat yadayim, tevilat yadayim. So here Rashi says that doesn't work because they don't have sufficient water there, as Rashi says, she'en kan shiur mikvit, that there's not sufficient water, 40 sa'ah, in the irrigation ditch, in order to allow one to do tevilat yadayim. On the other hand, other rishonim, like the Rosh, suggest that the failure over here is not the problem of 40 sa'ah. The problem or the failure over here is that this is mayim she'uvim. This is water that is drawn. And drawn water can't be kasher the mikveh. On the other hand, Rashi does not bring that reasoning of the Rosh, in all likelihood because the irrigation ditch itself is not considered to be a kli. Once you go into the irrigation ditch, it already flows, and it's something that's mechuber the karka, and therefore maybe it loses its shame she'uvim in that case. But then the nafkamina obviously will be that if you do have 40 sa'ah in there, according to Rashi, you could do tevilat yadayim. According to the Rosh, you could not do tevilat yadayim because of the fact that it is considered or classified as mayim she'uvim. So the only option that is left open to you is netilat yadayim, but you're too far away from where the water is filling the irrigation ditch for it to be considered koach gavra. On the other hand, if you get closer to where the bucket is pouring in, and that's what Rashi says over here, you put your hands close to where it's being poured in, and the water flows because of the bucket, because of that pouring. That already is considered to be koach rishon or koach gavro, and there you would be yotze netilat yadayim. It's similar to the bidko de maya that we saw back earlier in the Masechta on daf tet zayin, where if you tie someone up and put them right up against the dam, and then you remove the dam, in that case you will be responsible, because that's considered to be your koach that killed the individual, because directly as you pulled away the damming device, then the waters that either held up by the dam or that immediately come out without any delay are what caused the killing of the individual. But if you move the individual farther away from the dam, and then you pull the dam out, and then the water flows and then eventually gets to the individual, in that case, it would be considered klach sheni, grama, and you would not be culpable for killing the individual. Obviously, min ha-shamayim, there's a different story, but because there's no koach rishon, it's rather a koach sheni. That same distinction that we made back on Daf Tet Zayin is applicable over here as well. How close you are to the source will determine whether it's considered koach gavra or not considered to be koach gavra. Now, the Tosafot over here brings a bahag, which then forces him to redefine what koach gavra means. And that is perish behalachot gidolot, shemutar latvil yadayim mitoch hakli dechashiva nitzila. That if you have a utensil that's full of water, you don't have to just pour the water onto your hands in order for it to be nitilat yadayim. You can actually submerge your hands into the kli, and that would be the equivalent of nitilat yadayim. And he brings a raya from the kiyor, where the Gemara asks if an individual is allowed to dip their hands and legs into the kiyor for kiddush yadayim viraglayim. And the Gemara over there says that there's a specific zerat hakatov that doesn't allow one to do that. But the implications of that are that absent that gzeirat hakatuv, you would have been permitted to dip your hands and legs into the kior, and that would be the equivalent of kiddush yadayim viraglayim. So you see from that that the requirement of netilat yadayim doesn't just need to be that you pour it onto your hands. It might be even if you submerge your hands into the water in the kli. But the big problem with that explanation is our gemara over here, which requires koach gavra. Koach gavra sounds like you need to have a person activating and doing something active to pour the water onto their hands in order for it to be nitilat yadayim. So then Tosafot modifies the meaning of koach gavra over here and says, Mio yesh lomar, dvina nitila min akli, ben tovel yadav bitoch akli, ben shofech min akli yadav. That the real requirement over here is that either you need to have nitilat yadayim from a utensil. That means either you pour from the utensil onto your hands, or you submerge your hands into the utensil, Yeshkan nitila min akli. And the failure in our Gemara over here is that the water is already moved away from the kli. And so since they've distanced themselves from the kli, they're not considered to be a netila min akli, meaning not submerged in the kli and not from something that's poured out of the kli, which would have the waters be defined by the kli. And that's what the failure is over here. Bahadanaka dlo atu mikoach gavra lav davka. Our Gemara doesn't mean literally koach gavra. Ela mishum dlo atu mikoach kli. The real term that should have been used by the Gemara is not really koach gavra, but a koach kli. It has to come from a utensil. Koach kli can be manifest either in pouring from the kli onto your hands, or be manifest in you submerging your hands into the kli. So then the Baalei Tosafot bring a Mishnah from Yadayim, which seems to indicate that this exact issue that the Baalei Halachot Gedolot raises is actually Machloket Rabbi Yossi and the Chachamim, where Rabbi Yossi says you need koach gavra, and the Chachamim say that you need koach kli, the exact distinction that the Baalei Tosafot laid out over here. In that case, the Baalei Tosafot then suggests that unlike the first answer that they gave, which is koach gavra is lav dafka, and it really means koach kli over here, he says maybe the Gemara here is saying koach gavra dafka, and that's following the shita of Rabbi Yossi, and the Baalei Halachot Gedolot is following the shita of the Rabbanon. But then, if that's the case, then he says that we would have to be choshesh, the shita of Rabbi Yossi, because the Stama Gemara over here does it aliba the shita of Rabbi Yossi, and that means that the Gemara here thinks that the Halacha is like Rabbi Yossi, that koach gavra is required, not like what the Baalei Halachot Gedolot that says that only koach kli is required. And that is the way that we pass in the halacha, that koach gavra is the requirement and not just koach kli. As an aside, the Baalei Tosafot then bring two additional halachot with regards to netilat yadayim that are important. The first of which is, im adam notel yado achat, if a person washes one of his hands, v'chuzer mishafshef becharverta, and then he touches the other hand that wasn't washed yet, tzarich lachzor v'lito. Then you have to wash the hand that was washed already again. So you need to have both hands washed in order for them to touch each other. If only one is washed, and if the other one touches it, it's posel that hand, and you have to rewash that hand. The second halacha he brings is, v'tzarich lishpoch mayim yadav gimel pe'amim. Person has to pour water on each hand three times. The first time to clean his hands. The second time to be mitaher the yadayim, that's the netilat yadayim itself. And then the third time to wash away the waters that became tamei when they were being mitaher the yadayim. That would require three times on each hand, which we, in essence, accept the halacha, except for the fact that we require that if you wash your hands in order to clean them, we require that you dry the hands off first, and then only doing the tilat yadayim afterwards. So we end up doing these three times, just that it's the first washing is separate, and that's the washing to cleanse the hands, so there are no chatzitzot, and there's nothing there. Then after that, we wash twice, once to be mitaher the yadayim, and a second time to wash those waters away. But then the Baalei HaTosafot have what's otherwise a big kula that we don't use so much, which is umil. If a person in one shot pours a revi'it worth of mayim onto his hand, then you don't have to do it in separate pourings. The continuous flow simulates the effect of having multiple pourings onto the hand. And therefore, if you pour it all in one shot up to a revi'it onto his hands, the revi'it would be for both hands, so technically it would be a half a revi'it for each hand. That would suffice in terms of being metayer, the adayim of the individual. If he washes each hand separately, then the starting amount of water would have to be a revi'it, and then he would just have to pour enough water that would be the equivalent of, let's call it a half revi'it, because you just need to pour the amount of water that it would have been to be twice in one's hand. Just as an aside, the fact that the Baalei HaTosafot bring this, the halacha, which is mentioned by the Gemara here a little bit and in other places as well, that the requirement for netilat yadayim is a revi'it mayim, and then if one pours on one hand from that kli, the residual of the revi'it, which is called shayarei tahara, is then sufficient to pour on the other hand. That means that you're starting out with something with the in the range of 3.3 to 4.4 ounces of water, and you're pouring it on both hands. Now, in order to do that up to the wrist, that seems to be very little water to accomplish what we want to do, which is pour twice on each hand, given the revi'it of mayim. So that means you have to pour four times on the hands from a revi'it mayim, 3.3, 4.4 ounces. That's very little water to do that. And that makes one lean towards the shita of Rashi and the Baalei HaTosafot that we saw yesterday, that the necessity to wash one's hands is only up to the knuckles and not all the way up to the wrist. If you do that, then that amount of water probably would suffice. And again, the Baalei HaTosafot said yesterday makes a lot of sense, because the ikar, part of the goof that's interacting with the food and you're eating with, are your fingers, especially in their day when they weren't using utensils. It's the tips of the fingers, or the fingers themselves, that are engaged with the food, not the hand itself. And given that, it makes sense that you're washing up to the knuckles. If you're already washing up to the wrist, like many other poskim in the way that the Shulchan Aruch leans, as we said yesterday, then it would seem to be that you would need more water, even though nobody adjusts that halacha to say that the revi'it mayim would have to be greater in order to get to the wrist. But just thinking from a practical standpoint, it seems to be that a revi'it mayim wouldn't necessarily be sufficient to wash twice on each hand up to the wrist. And now they have a qualification in the Gemara, which is v'i b'zia davlo. If there is a hole in the kli, bikones mashke, with the ability to have water enter, meaning that in Masechet Kelim, there are two different types of holes that you can have in a kli. You can have a kli that has what's called motzi mashke, which is that water will escape from the kli if you put it inside. But if you submerge the kli into water without the top of the kli going below the surface of the water, that hole will not allow the water to enter because it's too small, and therefore the pressure of the water into such a small opening will not allow the water to enter into the kli. On the other hand, you can have a bigger hole, which not only allows water to escape from the kli, but also allows water to enter into the kli. So again, if you were to submerge the kli with the hole in it, with the surface of the kli being above the surface of the water, then water would enter into the kli because the hole is big enough for the water to enter into the kli, and there isn't sufficient pressure against the small hole, and therefore the water will enter into the kli. So if you have such a hole in the kli, milaf laife, it causes an aggregation or an overlapping, a connection between the two items, umaf bilbat yadayim, and therefore you're allowed to do tevilat yadayim. So in essence, as we described before, you are picking up water from the river and pouring it into the irrigation ditch. In this scenario where he picks it up from the river and then puts it into the irrigation ditch, at the same time he's pouring out of the kli into the irrigation ditch, there's a hole that's on the other side of the kli that has water pouring out of it back into the river. Or in essence, what it does is creates a chibur. It creates a connection between the two items, which is at the moment that you're pouring water into the irrigation ditch, at that same time there's water pouring out of the hole at the back of the kli back into the river. That means now you have an arc of water that connects between the river, which has the water from the hole connecting it into that which is in the kli, and then the kli itself, which is pouring water out into the ditch, which connects it to the ditch. That bridge between the two of them makes it now that the water in the irrigation ditch is now considered to be a continuation of the river. In that case, like you can do tevilat yadayim in the river, so too you can do tevilat yadayim in the irrigation ditch. Now, this is a kula with regard to tevilat yadayim. That is because, as Rashi points out over here, if it was a mikveh in order to have a chibur in mikveh, you need what's called kishfoferet hanot. You need to have something, a hole that's the size of which you can put in two fingers and turn them around. So that's a larger size or a larger requirement. That's what we use for nishika in order to be machshir mikvah today, where you have a bore in which the rainwater is. And then we have the other pool, which we empty and refill with waters that come through hamshacha into there. And then when we want to kasher those waters, we open up this shveret anod, this piping between them that causes a nishika between them, and that's metayer the waters in the mikveh. So as Rashi points out, that size hole that's required over there is shveret anod. But over here, because it's ntilat yadayim and tvilat yadayim is only a din der abonon, they were making over here that the bridging between the two or connecting between the waters doesn't need to be the size of kushveret anod. It only has to be the size of kones mashke. Tosfo notes as well that there's another failure over here, which is that by mikveh, we wouldn't say nitzo. Something that's being poured or in motion is not considered to be a chibur, a connection. And over here, by netilat yadayim, we'd also say it is a connection. And despite both of those deficits, we say it works here because they were mekio by netilat yadayim versus a case of tvilat kol gufo. And that's the kula that's being provided over here. But that kula then allows you to deem the waters in the irrigation ditch to be like the river. And that will allow you then to do tvilat yadayim, not netilat yadayim, but tvilat yadayim. Submerge your hands into the irrigation ditch, and then that will work for your tvilat yadayim, which will then obviate the necessity for doing netilat yadayim. From a Rova, and Rova says, kli shinikev bekones mashke, any utensil that has a hole in it that allows water to enter into the kli, einot nimi meno yadayim. You can't use that as a kli for netilat yadayim, because it's considered ois kli. It's no longer a kli when it has a hole that is kones mashke, and so you're not washing from a kli. In the scenario before, which Rova doesn't disagree with, you don't need a kli because you're trying to bridge between the river and the irrigation ditch. The less that is a kli, the better off you are, because then it just creates a arc of water or a connection between the two of them, and the kli is not interfering with that because it's not classified as a kli. But over here, we're not speaking about bridging, but here we're speaking about actually washing from this utensil. It's not classified as a utensil. If it has a hole in it the size of a konish mashke, it's no longer considered a kli. And since it isn't classified as a kli, you can't wash from it, because that's one of the requirements for netilat yadayim, is that it comes from a kli. Even if you don't believe, like we saw in the Baal Tosafot, they need koach gavra, you do need koach kli. It has to emanate from a kli itself. And this is not classified as a kli. Bidyavad, it is brought to halacha that if the kli holds a revi'it of mayim before it reaches the point where you have the whole of a konis mashke, that maybe over there that would be good for netilat yadayim bidyavad. Because even though there's no shame kli, you do have a shame kli that's enough or sufficient to hold the minimum requirement of water for netilat yadayim. And so b'diavad, you could use that kli. V'amar Rava, and that joins together with the next statement of Rava, which is kli, shame bo revit, einot nimi meno yadayim. That's the minimum shear of water that is necessary for netilat yadayim. And therefore the kli that you're washing from must have that minimum amount of water that you can do netilat yadayim with. And so therefore you need a kli that's machzik revi'it in order to do netilat yadayim. Ini, is that really true? V'amar Rava, kli shein machzik revi'it, einot nimi meno yadayim. There we see that a kli that doesn't hold a revi'it, you can't wash your hands. Ha, machzik. If it does hold a revi'it, avagav de late bay, even though it doesn't have in it, it is sufficient in order to do netilat yadayim. So what the Gemara is doing is bringing a stira in Rava's statements, which is that Rava in one place is saying you need a kli that holds a revi'it mayim, and it has to have a revi'it mayim in the kli. So that's the first statement of Rava. The second statement of Rava says that the kli has to be able to hold a revi'it in order for it to be kasher. From there, it sounds like it doesn't actually have a revi'it in it. It just has to be the size of kli that can hold a revi'it. So then, which is it? Is the requirement that you have a revi'it mayim, or is the requirement that you have a kli that can hold a revi'it mayim, but you don't need a revi'it mayim? The Gemara says, Lokasha, that's not a stira in Rava. How the chad, how the tray. The difference being whether one person or two people are washing from this kli. In order to start netilat yadayim, the minimum amount of water that you need is a revi'it mayim, because that's considered to be what's called the shi'ur tahara. It is the minimum size that's allowed to be used for tahara, and you must begin with that minimum amount. But as long as you have started with the revi'it mayim, then any residual from that water that started with the revi'it is called shi'arei tahara, the residual of tahara, and that residual of tahara is sufficient or good enough to do netilat yadayim with. So the first individual came to wash his hands. Since there was a revirat mayim in the kli, he can wash his hands from that water because it meets the minimum standard of revirat mayim and a kli that can hold the revirat mayim. Once he's washed his hands, the next individual then doesn't need to refill the kli. He can use the kli, even though there's less than revirat mayim in there, he can use the kli to wash his hands because they came from a revirat mayim originally, and they're called shayrei tahara, and that is sufficient to allow one to wash their hands from that kli. So again, here, I just reiterate the fact that if you're starting out with revirat mayim and washing your hands, and then there's another person going to wash his hands from that same revirat mayim, the residual of that revirat mayim, doesn't seem to be that you're washing a large portion of your hand or all the way up to the wrist with a revirat mayim, which is only about 3.3 to 4.4 ounces of water, and two people are washing from that, means that there are four hands being washed twice in that scenario. And again, it favors those opinions that say that washing up to the knuckles is what's required, not up to the wrist. And again, if you were going to wash up to the wrist, it would seem like you would need more water in order to accomplish that. That's not, because you have a Mishnah on Yadayim that supports this contention, may revi'it notlim liyadayim. If you have water that the size of revi'it, you can wash hands, le'achad, v'afilu lishnayim. One person can wash, or even two people can wash. And so you see that once you start out with the revi'it of mayim, you don't need the revi'it of mayim to be there when one washes their hands. It just has to have started with the revi'it mayim. And once you start with the revi'it mayim, whatever's left there is considered to be shayrei tahara, is kasher for netilat yadayim. Amar le Rav Sheshet da'meimar, kaptitu amano. So Rav Sheshet queries of a meimar when it comes to netilat yadayim, what are the things that you are particular about? He says, kaptitu amano, are you careful to only do netilat yadayim from a kli? Amar le in. He said, yes, we do. Achazuta, are you makpid on the appearance of the water? Amar le in. He said, yes. So over here, as Tosafot points out, that the water cannot be discolored or not have something that is makes it look like it's not water over here, because that is something that's posel the gabei netilat yadayim. And Tosafot brings examples from the Mishnayot and Yadayim, which is if there's ink or there's copper residue inside the water that changes the color of the water, then they are psulim. Although we had back in the Gemara in Zvachim that when if dirt or sediment is in the water, that's not posel the water for netilat yadayim. And the reasons are brought by the Mishnah Brura, either because that is the natural way that water comes. When one draws water, there is dirt in it, there is sediment in it, and therefore it's not classified as being something that changes the mar'eh or the chazuta of the water, and that's why it is kasher. Or because if you let the water stand, eventually the sediment or the dirt that's in the water will settle to the bottom and leave you clear water. So for both of those reasons, if you have dirt or sediment that's inside the water that comes from its natural source, then that's not something that is posel the chazuta of the mayim. But if it's something else that's placed into the water or mixed into the water that ruins the appearance of the water, then that is something that is pasul le netilat yadayim. So then he says, ashi'ura, are you makpid that you have a minimum shi'ur, meaning a revi'it, in order to do netilat yadayim? Amalei in. He said, yes. So these are all halachot with regards to netilat yadayim, the requirement that you have a minimum of a revi'it mayim, at least when you start, that the appearance be the appearance of water and not something else that is discoloring or ruining the water. And there might be that you do the netilat yadayim from a kli, from a utensil. Igadamre, hachi amarle. Some suggest that this was the nature of the conversation. Amano v'chazuta kabdinon. He says that with regards to a kli and the appearance of the waters, we are makpid. Ashiura lo kabdinon. But with regards to a shiur, we're not makpid on having a minimum shiur. That's not. We have a Mishnah from Yadayim that says, may revi'it notlim liyadayim. That if you have a revi'it, you can wash one hand le'achat. Even for two. So it sounds like there is no minimum shiur. Below it, that's not the case, because shiny hotam. It's different over there. Mishum tka'atu mishayrei tahara. Like we explained before, the reason that the second person doesn't need the minimum required of a revi'it is because the kli started out with the revi'it. And now this individual is taking that residual from the revi'it, and that is sufficient. So that's not an indication that there's no necessity for a revi'it. Just an indication that if you start with a revi'it, then the residual of that revi'it takes on the properties as if it is a revi'it or it's met the minimum shiur. And so that's why it's not a good proof to the second version. And the Gemara is rejecting that and saying that you need all three of these items. You need hakpada on the kli, on the appearance, and on the shiur over here. So now, itkin Rav Yaakov Minar Pakud, so Rav Yaakov Minar Pakud instituted Natla Bat Revi'ata. He made a kli that was the size of a revi'it. Rashi over here says that Natla Bat Revi'ata is shel zchuchit. It is a glass utensil, and therefore kari Natla. And that's why it's called a Natla, because of the fact that it is made from glass, and it was put away in the Ministry of Measurements in order that people could come, and then when they made a kli, they could measure it against the standard revi'it, meaning that he made a kli that hold a revi'it for everybody to come and measure and use as the standard for what is a revi'it. And itkin Rav Ashi behutzal kuza bat revi'ata. And Rav Ashi did the same thing in hutzal, but he did it with a kuza, a pitcher. And Rashi over here claims that a kuza is made out of cheres, out of earthenware, and therefore it's called a kuza, not a natla. And he did the same thing. He created a standard that was a revi'it, which everybody could come and measure against in order to know that they had a revi'it in their kli. And this is actually one of the sources for the fact that it's called netilat yadayim, and that is that some Rishonim suggest over here that it comes from the kli, the utensil that was used for netilat yadayim, which is called a natla. And the natla holds that minimum shiur of a revi'it mayim, like was established over here. And that's why it's called netilat yadayim, because you did it from a natla, a kli that held a revi'it mayim. Others suggest that it comes from the word notulin, which means to raise up or to elevate. And the pasuk says, su yedeichem kodesh uvarchu et Hashem, that one raises their hands in order to give bracha to Hashem. And that is the requirement that one washes their hands. And therefore it's called netilat yadayim, the raising of one's hands, because elevation either physically of the hands once you've washed them, or spiritually the hands have now become tahor, so they're being elevated, su yedeichem kodesh, then that's called netilat yadayim. So this actually might be one of the sources for the fact that it's called netilat yadayim, is because of this kli called the natla. Vama rabba megufat chavit shetikna, if you have a cover of a barrel that you have now fixed, so that it can, as Rashi says over here, it can now have a beit kibul in it, it's made to be a cover. So in general, it doesn't have a beit kibul. And Rashi says, now you fixed it so that it has a receptacle in it. And given that it now has a receptacle that holds a revi'it, you can use it for washing one's hands. Ba'al Tosafot, on the other hand, say that it already is a receptacle. The problem is that it comes to a point on the other side. So even though it has a receptacle when it's held upside down, and that's what's used to cover the barrel or whatever item it is, but it has a little knob on the top. That knob on top makes it, when you turn it around and you're trying to put something into its receptacle, it falls over, it slips over. And so mitakna, according to the Ba'al Tosafot, is that you fix that knob on the other side so that the pot cover or the barrel cover could sit straight without tipping over. And that's the hatkana that you did over here, the fixing that you did over here, in order to make it ro'oi for netilat yadayim. Tanya Nami Ochi, we have a braita that supports that. Migufat chavit, if you have a cover of a barrel, shetikna, that was fixed, either according to Rashi, to make it into a receptacle, or into a toaster, make it that it could stand up by itself. You can use it for netilat yadayim. Chemet v'kfisha, these are wine skins, or a leather flask. So these items, shetiknam, that have been fixed, don't mehem the yadayim. You can use them for netilat yadayim, since they originally are made as kelim that can be utilized for liquids, because they store liquids in them, and therefore, if you use them or set them aside to be used for netilat yadayim, then they function in that way and it works. On the other hand, sak vikupa, a sack or a basket, afobish mekablim, even though they have a receptacle to take in liquids, ain't not mehem the yadayim. They are not considered to be kelim for washing one's hands, because they were not originally made to hold liquids, or that's not the normal thing that's done with these items in order to hold liquids. And therefore, if you utilize them for netilat yadayim, they're not classified as a kli, which is one of the things that we said before was a requirement of netilat yadayim. And that's likely because of its correlation with kiddush yadayim raglayim in the mikdash, which has to be done from the kior, from a kli. And in all likelihood, the netilat yadayim is patterned after this kiddush yadayim raglayim of the mikdash, and we require a kli. And what the Gemara here is discussing is what's classified as a kli for liquids, or suffices as a kli for liquids. Something that's made to deal with liquids, or something that's fixed that can have a receptacle for liquids, and it's called a kli, that works. But something like a sak and a kupa, which are not usually used for liquids, and even if you can make them waterproof, they're just not the normal way that people store or utilize for liquids, then that's not considered to be a kli vis-a-vis liquids, and you can't use that for the washing of one's hands. Ibailuhu, mahu lechol b'mapa. The Gemara wants to know now, is it possible to eat the food without washing one's hands, but by not touching the food? If you put a mapa, if you wrap your hands up in some sort of cloth or in some cover, gloves, and therefore you're not going to touch the food directly, is that okay if you don't wash your hands? Michashinan dilmanoga. Do we worry about the fact that even though he's got his hands covered, he might eventually come to touch the food, and therefore with that nitilati daim, it's not sufficient? Alone, or maybe we don't worry about that. And if you have your hands covered, it's the equivalent of washing your hands, because you don't worry about you touching it. Tashma, ukushinatnu lo the Rabbi Tzadok, ochel pachot mikabetza, not lo bemapa, bochlo chutz lesuka, veimivarei chacharav. It's from a Mishnah in the Gemara in Sukkah. And over there, it's telling a story about Rabbi Tzadok, from which you learn a number of dinim. They gave Rabbi Tzadok a piece of bread that was less than a kabetza, which the minimum shiur for benching is a kabetza. It's a machloket tanaim. And this is like the sheet of Rabbi Yehuda, that in order to be chayav in benching, you need vachalta visavata, achila that brings the date svi'a. And the minimum of achila that brings the date svi'a is a kabetza worth of food. If you don't hit that minimum shiur of kabetza, then you don't have a requirement to be mivarei chacharav. You don't have a requirement to say a brocha achrona. Although, as the Bali Tosafot point out over here, that's only true with regards to a brocha achrona. But a brocha rishona does not have any minimum requirement. And even though the Gemara, in the beginning of a Ketzad Mivarchim, learns out brocha rishona from a kal v'chomer from brocha achrona, and then if you invoke the principle of dayo, that you can't learn more than what the origins are, which is brocha achrona, so then how could a brocha rishona require a lower shiur for bracha than the bracha achrona? Vaitos would say that kavachomer is just a giloi milta and not a real limud. Because if it was a real limud, then the kavachomer would make a bracha rishona midoraita. And we know that bracha rishona is only a din derabonon, and bracha achrona, or at least benching, is a din deoraita. And since we don't, through a kavachomer, create a din deoraita bracha rishona, you see that it's just a method or mechanism for showing that there's a necessity of a bracha rishona, but it's not actually a real limud, because otherwise then bracha rishona would be doraita. But that's an important distinction, and many people make this mistake, that when you eat less than a shiur, you may not have to say a bracha achrona, but you always have to make a bracha rishona in order to eat it, because it's a birkat hananin, and you're getting hana from it. And number two is, the Gemara there in the beginning of Ketzad Mivarchim says, if you put anything into your mouth without making a bracha, it's chilul, you're stealing from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and therefore it's always necessary to make a bracha rishona. The only question is with regards to a bracha achrona. So over here, he holds like the shita of Rabbi Yehuda. We are generally choshesh for the opposing opinion that a kezayit is sufficient to obligate a bracha achrona, at least midrabanan, and then it would elevate itself to a bracha deoraita once you hit a kebetza. That's one halacha that we learn from there. The second halacha we learned is that he ate outside the sukkah on Sukkot because it was less than a kebetza, and therefore it shows you that you need to have at least a minimum of a kebetza in order to obligate one to eat in the sukkah. And the third halacha is the one that we're after over here, which is he didn't wash his hands, but rather he notlo b'mapa. He took it without washing his hands and wrapped his hands up and took it with some handkerchief or napkin wrapped around his hands, and he carried the bread. And so that's the Gemara says over here. My love, hai kebetza boi netilat yadayim. What you would learn from that is, only if it was less than a kebetza would you be allowed to use this mapa. But had it been above the level of a kebetza, then we would require netilat yadayim, even if you had a mapa around your hands. So the diuk they want to make is, the only reason Rabbi Tzadok did this is because it was below that minimum shiur. Once you cross over that threshold of the shiur, we would require you to do netilat yadayim. Mar says, Dilma, ha kebetza boi suko boi brocha. Now maybe the threshold of the kebetza is for the other two dinim that are in the Mishnah over there. The din that you require sukkah and the din that you require bracha achrona. It happens to be that they also mentioned about the mapa, but it's not governed by that threshold. And maybe even above that threshold, you could still use a mapa. And the reason they used a kebetza was for the other two dinim that are brought there. Tashma, the Shmuel ashche the Rav, the ka'achil b'mapa. Shmuel came to visit Rav, and he sees that Rav's eating bread with a mapa, with a handkerchief or some sort of napkin or tablecloth around his hands. Amalei avdin kedain. You're allowed to do this. You don't have to wash your yadayim, and you're allowed to eat without washing your yadayim and use something wrapped around your hands. Amalei dati ketzara alai. Says that I am a istinis. I'm very particular. I don't like getting my hands dirty with food. And as Rashi points out over here, Rav already washed until at yadayim. He had washed until at yadayim. The only reason he was using the mapa was because of cleanliness. He didn't like getting his hands dirty when he ate. Again, there are no utensils in their day. They eat with their hands. So in order to keep his hands clean, he put something around his hands to protect them from the mess that would come from eating with your fingers or eating with your hands. But not that he didn't do Yetilat Yadayim. He had done Yetilat Yadayim. He just now was covering his hands in order to protect them from getting dirty. And that's what he was saying to Shmuel, implying again that there is a necessity to wash one's hands, and having a mapa around the hands would not be sufficient. Kitzolik Rabbi Zera, when Rabbi Zera went to Eretz Yisrael, Ashkechino the Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asi, de Ka'achle, Bivlai, Chamatot. That he saw that Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi were used worn down flasks, meaning skins or leather that they put on their hands in order to eat. Amar, Tre Gavre, Ravrave, Kavataychu, two great Talmidei Chachamim like you, Litu, but Rav and Shmuel are making a mistake about the understanding of what transpired between Rav and Shmuel. Ha, dati kitzara kamar. That incident with Rav and Shmuel, where Rav was eating with the mapa, he told Shmuel that he had washed his hands. The reason he put a mapa on his hands was not to avoid Nitilat Yadayim, but rather because he was an Istinus, and he didn't want to get his hands dirty. And now you guys are doing this halacha? Ishtematite, Rabbi Zera forgot about Hadamar Rav Tachlifa Barav Yime Amar Shmuel, another member from Shmuel, hey, tiru mapad ochle truma, that those that eat truma do not have an obligation to wash necessarily. They can use a mapa. Below he tiru mapad ochle tarot. But that's not true with people who eat al kedushat ha kodesh or for the ochle tarot or ochle kodoshim. The reason being is because there's a difference between truma and kodoshim. Truma is something that's only eaten by kohanim, and kohanim are zrizimheim, and therefore they're not going to touch the item if they use a mapa. We don't have to worry about Nitilat Yadayim. On the other hand, ochle tarot or ochle kodoshim, which is open to not only kohanim but to the hamon am, in that instance we will not allow you to use the mapa because of the risk that the individual, if they don't wash their hands, might come to touch the food, which is problematic. And Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asi, Kohanim Avu. Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi were Kohanim, and they were eating Truma, and that's what slipped Rabbi Zera's mind, that they were permitted to do such a thing. Now, it turns out, interesting enough, that it's almost counterintuitive. As we saw in yesterday's daf, the whole point, or the whole institution of Netilat Yadayim is because of Srach Truma, is because of Truma, and because of the Chashash of Tuma, vis-a-vis Truma, at least Midrabanan. And now, in the world of Truma, we're giving permission to eat without Netilat Yadayim and with a mapa. So even though the institution in Chulin was only to uphold the institution of Truma, nevertheless, we're allowing by Truma to you to abrogate that and use the mapa and not do Netilat Yadayim. It's just an interesting outcome from the situation, but as a result of the fact that Kohanim Zrizimheim. And the halacha is, at least brought down in Shulchan Aruch, if there is a place where a person doesn't have Mayim, not having Mayim, as we'll see later on in Chulin, has to do with that you can't find Mayim if you continue on your journey for four meal, or if you backtrack on your journey for one meal, there's no water in that area, then you can eat without Nitilat Yadayim using a mapa. So what we would call maybe a shatat dechak or a difficult situation. The Ramah does bring down bidiavad that using utensils might be the same or the equivalent of using a mapa, but the Shulchan Aruch does say that you have to cover both hands when you're eating, even if you're only eating with one hand. Although, according to the Ramah, who says that utensils are sufficient, it would seem that b'shat ha-tchak you could use only one hand, be covered, quote-unquote, because you're using utensils in one hand, and that suffices over there. But again, all of this is b'shat ha-tchak. This is not something that replaces Nitilat Yadayim. It's not something that displaces Nitilat Yadayim. It's in a situation where one has no access to water whatsoever, then you can use the mapa as a replacement. Okay, Bailu. Now we move on to another question with regards to Nitilat Yadayim. Ochel machmat machil. Someone who's eating by being fed by someone else. Tarich Nitilat Yadayim alo. Do we worry about the person who's eating and being fed by someone else? Do they require Nitilat Yadayim? Tashma. The Rav Huna Bar Schora. Havakai Kameh the Rav Hamnuna. Rav Huna Bar Schora was there in front of Rav Hamnuna. Balam Lai Umtza. And Rav Huna Bar Schora fed Rav Hamnuna a piece of roasted meat or a piece of barbecued meat. It's obvious here that the umsa must include something else because you don't require Nitilat Yadayim to eat basar, so it must incorporate some sort of bread over here. As far as what the word balam means, Rashi brings two interpretations of what balam means. Either balam means chatach, that he cut off a small piece from a larger piece and he gave it to him, or Rashi brings the second interpretation, which balam means sgor, or to close up. And it means he buried a piece of meat in the coals for him, and then gave it to him to eat. Or there are others that suggest the word Balaam really comes from the word Balaam or Balas, which means to mix up, and that's because of what the Baal Tosafot say in the top here, Perushu Patima, that Balaam Leumtza means that there was bread mixed in with it, and that's what he gave to him, Ba'achil, and he ate it. Amalei, so Rav Huna Bar Schora says to Rav Amnuna, Ilav Rav Amnuna at, had you not been Rav Amnuna, Lo Safina Lecha, I would not have fed you this item, my taima. What's the reason he said that? Why did he say he wouldn't have fed it to him? Elim Kin, that he's from Amnuna. La Mishum de Zahir Velo Noga. Because he was careful and he wouldn't touch it. It shows from here that the person who is being fed doesn't need to do it until it's Yudayim. And Rav Huna Bar Schora felt comfortable giving it to Rav Amnuna because he knew Rav Amnuna wouldn't touch the item. And for that reason, it was permissible to do such. But that would indicate that you do not require washing of the hands when you're bringing someone that is being fed and you're not touching directly the ochel. Now, the proof from here is a little difficult because he makes a statement that he only did it because of Rav Amnuna. And how can you extrapolate that to a broader context or a broader group of individuals? Because here we're talking about Rav Amnuna. So you have to say that even if that was the reason why he was willing to give it to Rav Amnuna, if there was a necessity to wash hands just because Rav Amnuna was Zahir, wouldn't have allowed him to feed it to him without doing it Tehillat Yudayim. We generally have a position of low plug that whenever the Rabbanan say something, we don't make it subjective or determine who does or doesn't need to do it. If there was such an institution, even Rav Amnuna would have had to have done it. All Rav Huna Bar Schora was saying is that I'm comfortable doing it with Rav Amnuna because I know for sure he won't touch it. But that means that on a broader basis, that is the halacha that one doesn't need to wash. Mar says, lo, dezariz vikodim umashiyadei mi'ikara. Now what he said is, I know you're Rav Amnuna, therefore I don't worry about feeding you, which is, I know you always wash your hands beforehand. And so he didn't worry about the fact that he had washed his hands. He assumed that he had washed his hands because he was Rav Amnuna. And Rashi here makes a point that a zariz is a div mizahir. Zahir is someone who's careful, shiodeli zahir b'shat maseh. When something's in front of him, he deals with the issue that is immediate and a potential problem so that he won't let the mitzvah go by or he won't abrogate the requirements. On the other hand, a zariz is a ru'et anulad. That's someone who has perspective and the ability to see into the future and be prescriptive in their actions rather than just reactive in their actions. And that's why a zariz is greater than a zahir. And that's what Rashi says is the memra in Avodah Zarah, which is also the background for the Mesilat Yesharim, which is that zihirut may be the day's rizut. Zihirut leads to zrizut because rizut is a higher level. And that's what the compliment that was being paid to Rav Amnuna here, that he was a zariz. He had the foresight to always wash ahead of time, and that's why Rav Huna wasn't worried about Rav Amnuna and feeding him, because he knew that he must have washed before he came to sit down over here. And then that would show you that you do need to wash your hands. So there's nothing conclusive that comes out of this. Tashma, Damar Rabbi Zera Amarav, Lo Yidein Adam Prusa L'toch Piv Shel Shamash. A person may not put a piece of food into the mouth of the waiter who is servicing them, unless you know that he already washed his hands. And the shamash has to make a bracha on every cup of wine that he drinks, because after each cup that he drinks, he's not certain that he will get another cup. And therefore each one is a new bracha for him because it's not incorporated or captured by the single bracha that he makes. On the other hand, he doesn't have to make a bracha or a separate bracha on each piece of food that he gets, because he's pretty certain that they're not going to withhold food from him. They're not going to prevent them from eating or participating in the meal, even though it might be broken up or it might be done piecemeal. He still knows that he will get a chance to eat during the meal. So therefore, one brocha is sufficient with regards to kol prusa prusa. That's not true by kos, but kos by the wine, because that's much more of a premium item. And therefore, he's not certain that he's going to get another chance to drink. And therefore, he's mesiach dati from it. He needs to make another brocha. And Rabbi Yochanan says he has to make a bracha on each piece of food or bread that is given to him because of the same reason by kos for kos. Papa says, Bishlam adarav Rabbi Yochanan lo kasha. We can reconcile between Rav and Rabbi Yochanan with regards to prusa prusa. Hadik adam chashuv, hadalek adam chashuv. It depends on the guests that are there. If there is someone who is of a significant status or stature in the suda, then the shamash is certain that they will give him whatever he needs to eat because of this important guest that's there. And therefore the shamash will be treated by the important guest, or in honor of that guest, he will be given food. On the other hand, if there's nobody important there, he's not certain that he will get extra food or get items, and therefore his bracha doesn't count. Rav's statement, therefore, is not in contradiction to that of Rabbi Yochanan, but the other part of Rav's statement is important to us, which is you're not allowed to feed the shamash, and Lame Cain, he had washed his hands. And that would answer our question when you're feeding someone else, that they would have to wash their hands in advance. So the Gemara says, Mikom akom hakamar, Elim Cain yodesh natal yadav. So there it says that you need to know that he washed his hands. Where it says, Shani shamash detarid. The problem with the shamash is that he is bogged down. He has other things or other concerns, and therefore he'll forget himself and touch the food. So, afa pishno gea b'chol suda, even though he touches all the food that's served in the meal, Rashi says, Rashi says, you only need netilat yadayim when you're eating, you don't need netilat yadayim when you're touching. And we saw this again in the Baal Yad Tosafot on yesterday's daf as well, which is there's a distinction between touching items, where you don't require netilat yadayim, versus eating items where you do require netilat yadayim. So the shamash does not require netilat yadayim in order to serve the meal or to touch the food that's being presented. On the other hand, he does need to wash yadayim in order to eat it. And the problem is, if he didn't wash his hands to eat the meal and you're feeding him or giving him food to eat during the meal, then we would be worried about the fact that he'll be bogged down, focused on other matters of the meal, and it'll touch the food that you're putting into his mouth or touch the food in his mouth. And therefore, we require netilat yadayim in order to protect against that. But that doesn't mean that that's a global rule that anybody who's being fed needs to wash their hands. It might be unique to a shamash, to a waiter. So now Gemara says, all right, Tanu Rabbanan. And along these lines, we have a braita that's supportive of that which we saw from Rav, and that is, Lo yiten adam prusa l'shamash, ben shakos biyado, ben shakos biyado shel bal habayit. You shouldn't give a prusa to the shamash to eat, whether he's holding a cup of wine or the drink, whether the bal habayit is holding the cup. Shema ye'are davar kalkala basuda. Because maybe something will go untoward in the meal. Rashi over here interprets like he did 2 days ago with the kalkala basuda, means that the person might choke. He might object to the fact that the shamash is being given food to eat. Or the bal habayit will get angry, and that'll cause him to choke on the drink. Or he brings the second interpretation, which is brought by the Ravenu Gershom on 2 days ago, daf, which is that maybe he'll spill the wine, or he'll spill the drink, or the bal habayit will get angry, and that'll cause the food or the other items to get ruined during the suda. So one should not give the shamash to eat, and that's not speaking about the bal habayit, it's speaking about one of the guests. If one of the guests thinks that they should be able to give to the shamash, the bal habayit is in charge of the shamash, and you don't want to upset or anger the bal habayit by giving him or not giving him. It's not your place, either because he doesn't want the waiter to have, or maybe because he doesn't have enough food to serve all the individuals that are there, or because the bal habayit is going to look to see what's going on or what's happening, or the shamash is going to look to see what someone's giving him, and it's going to cause something to spill or something to happen that would be less than pleasant, and therefore you're not allowed to do that in the middle of the meal. Vashamash. In addition to that, a shamash that hasn't washed his hands, you can't put food into his mouth. And the Rishonim point out over here that this has broader implications, and it's brought to halacha, that one is not allowed to feed food or give items to an individual who will not deal with them properly. That means you can't give bread to someone who's not going to wash, and you can't give food to someone who's not going to make a bracha on the food. And so from this, they parlay this into a much broader context that the yodea over here means that you need to know that the person's going to do the proper thing halakhically when you give them the item. Now, that's somewhat mitigated by the fact that many times giving food to an individual or feeding someone is a mitzvah of gmilut chesed or tzedakah. And in those cases, maybe you could give it even if you don't know that they're going to do this. Although most of the poskim, the Mishnah Berurah, says this in Siman Kuf Samach Tet, that it's not that you know that they won't do it, you just don't know what they're going to do. And since you don't know what they're going to do, it's okay to give them tzedakah, it's always good to give them food, but if you do know for certain that they're not going to make a bracha or not wash their hands, that would cause a problem. There is a tshuva in the Minchat Shlomo from Shlomo Zalman Orbach about a big gvir that came to visit a yeshiva who he was a big toreim to, and the gvir happened not to be someone who was religious. And so they were asking Rav Shlomo Zalman whether they had to insist that he washed his yadayim and made all the brachot, which would offend him and be pogea in his kavod, because that wasn't something that he normally practiced. If they did that, he would be offended by it. Do they have to then insist on that because that's the halacha? Or is it a problem to invite him to come to the yeshiva because of that? So Rav Shlomo Zalman over there has a huge chiddush with regards to lifnei iver lo titein mechshol, which has major implications in many areas of halacha that we've discussed before with regards to lifnei iver lo titein mechshol, which is that you have to look at it at a more holistic level, which is that, yes, if you give him this particular item, he's not going to wash his yadayim, he's not going to make a bracha on the food. But if you look at this from a broader context, this individual is kashur to the Olam HaTorah and the Olam HaLacha now because he's a Torah to the yeshiva. He respects the Rosh Yeshiva and respects Torah. And that's all been engendered by his donating to the yeshiva and being a part of this yeshiva. If you then tell him something that's going to offend him and chase him away, not only will he lose out and you won't get him to make a bracha until he dies, but he also loses kesher to Torah as a whole. So you have to look at this from a more holistic viewpoint as to whether this is creating or engendering kiruv rechukim, bringing someone closer to the Torah, making someone feel more positive about Jews and Torah, versus whether the particular halacha or the minute halacha in this instance is being abrogated and having a problem lifnei iver lo titen mechshol. And he says you have to look at lifnei iver not on a piece-by-piece basis on every little halacha, but you have to look at it on a global perspective. Are you doing something that's positive with this individual or are you doing something that's negative? And that has obviously implications. The kiruv rechukim, it's a huge chiddush of Rosh Shlomo Zalman, and it really relates to what's being said over here about knowing what's going to happen when you give an individual something to eat or food to eat, whether they're going to do the proper thing or act in the proper manner. Hey, Bayalu. Now the Gemara flips the question in the other direction, which is, Ma'achil tzarich netilat yadayim wainu tzarich. The person who's doing the feeding, do they need netilat yadayim? Or is it only the ochel, the one who is eating, that requires netilat yadayim? Tashma, titani debei menashe, we have a braita from debei midrash of menashe, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel omer, isha medichat yada achat b'mayim v'notenet pat livna katan, that a woman has to wash one of her hands in order to feed her child food on Yom HaKippurim. So that's Yom Kippur where it's asur berechitza. Nevertheless, we allow the woman to wash her hand on Yom HaKippurim in order to feed her child, which seems to indicate that if you are the ma'achil, you have an obligation to wash. And in order to feed the child, we permit you to wash on Yom Kippur in order to feed the child. He did not want to wash his hand and feed the child on Yom Kippur. And therefore, there were goals on him that he had to do with both hands and wash both hands. They did not want this to become the halacha, and therefore they wanted to institute and ensure that people understood what Shammai was doing was incorrect, and therefore they made him wash both hands and feed the child, and that showed that it was inappropriate to withhold food from a child on Yom Kippur, because you didn't want to wash your hands on Yom Kippur. They thought that was incorrect, and so they made him wash both hands to show that it's something you must do, and that you don't have a choice in the matter. If the child needs to eat, and it's something for his sustenance, which is necessary on Yom HaKippurim, there's no way that you can withhold food from him. If that requires you to wash your hands, then you're permitted to wash your hands on Yom HaKippurim. But what you see here is that these are instances of being ma'achil to other people, and we're requiring netilat yadayim. So Ravaye hata mishum shifta. Over there, it's because of the problem of shifta. Rashi over here claims that shifta is ruach ra'ash u'shorel yadayim. It is this evil spirit that descends on the hands, shalonat lushacharit, that you didn't wash in the morning, negelvasser. So as long as you've done negelvasser in the morning, it wouldn't be a problem. From Rashi, it implies that they didn't do negelvasser on Yom HaKippurim. The only reason they did do negelvasser over here was because they were feeding someone else. That's Rashi's view as to what Mishum Shifta is. Bayuto Sufot bring from the Rabbeinu Tam, who say that that doesn't make any sense, because the Rabbeinu Tam says that you can wash negelvasser on the morning of Yom HaKippurim, because there's no restriction against washing your hands from dirt on Yom Kippur or on Tisha B'Av. It's only Rechitza Shel Hana'ah that is problematic. To wash up dirt or anything that is problematic, you're allowed to do on Yom Kippur and on Tisha B'Av. And therefore, just like there's physical dirt, there's also spiritual dirt. And that means that if you wake up in the morning and you have a ruach ra on your hands, there's no question that your hands are maluch lachot, and you can wash them on Yom Kippurim. You can do negelvasser. We discussed yesterday, maybe there's a limit. You can't do the full hand. You only do it up to the knuckles, but you can wash negelvasser. So then the Rabbeinu Tam explains that the shifta over here is not the ruach ra from going to sleep overnight, but rather the shifta is kamosh perish Rabbeinu Chanan shuruach ra shu'al ochel. It's this evil spirit or demon that descends on food. Kishabalitain hapat letinok ben dal behe. When you're feeding young children who are 4 or 5 years old, v'choneket oto, and it causes them to choke im lo natal yadav boto shah, if the person who's feeding them didn't wash their hands. So afal pish natal shacharit has nothing to do with whether you washed or didn't wash for negelvasser in the morning. Ma she'enanu nizari machshav mizeh. How come we don't worry about this? We don't wash our hands before we feed children who are 4 or 5 years old. How come we aren't concerned with this? Because he says, she'en ruach ra mitzuya beinenu. That ruach ra is not found amongst us. Just like we're not careful about the Zugot that are mentioned in Arvei Psachim, as well as Giloy, which we discussed back in Avodah Zarah, which is water or items that are left exposed because they're not relevant in our time or in the places that we live. And since this isn't found amongst us, we're not careful about it. But that's what the Gemara is answering. The Gemara is answering that the washing here was because of that Ruach Ra'a. It wasn't because someone who feeds someone else is required to wash their hands. Atashma. So we're going to bring a proof from a different case, which is Davua de Shmuel, Shmuel's father, Ashkechei de Shmuel, when he was a young kid, the Kabochi, that he was crying. He says, why are you crying? He says, the Machin Rabbi, my Rebbe hit me. So Amai, Shmuel's father said, why did he hit you? He says, Damali, Kasafit Libray, Velo Mashid Yadecha, because you're feeding my child, and you didn't wash your hands. I mean, Shmuel was giving food to the Rebbe's child, and Shmuel didn't wash beforehand. Vamailo Mashit. So Shmuel's father says to him, why didn't you wash? Amalei, hu achil v'ana mashina? He says, the child of the Rebbe is eating, and I need to wash my yadayim. Amalei, so Shmuel's father says to Shmuel, lo mistai delo gomir, it's not enough that this Rebbe of yours didn't learn Torah. Mimche nami mochi, and then he hits based on his wrong assumption about the din over here. Because you were right, Shmuel, that if you're feeding someone else, you do not have a requirement to wash your hands. Now, the reason Shmuel's father asked Shmuel about whether he did or didn't wash his hands, even though he knew that the halacha is that if you feed someone else, you don't need to wash your hands, is because he wanted to understand why Shmuel didn't wash his hands. Is it because Shmuel wasn't makbid on netilat yadayim? Or was it because Shmuel knew the halacha that a machil doesn't need to wash his hands? And then when he said that the machil doesn't need to wash his hands, then Shmuel's father was satisfied with Shmuel's understanding of the halacha, and then he criticized the Rebbe who didn't know the halacha, and on top of not knowing the halacha, he hits even when he's wrong about the halacha. The Hilchoton, the Gemara concludes, the halacha is, Okel machmat machil tzarich netilat yadayim. The one who's being fed, the one who is eating, even if he's being fed by someone else, they do require netilat yadayim. Ma'achil, the one who's feeding the individual, einu tzarich netilat yadayim, does not require netilat yadayim. So the halacha is like what Shmuel and Avuah de Shmuel said over here. And again, from the cases before where we said that the one who's eating, from the all the different proofs that we brought, we tried to find a way to show that they weren't necessarily proofs. In the end, we do agree that the person who's eating does require netilat yadayim. And therefore, the shamash and all those other cases, there is a requirement of netilat yadayim in all of those instances, not just because they're tarud or because of the other things that we said, but because they are the one eating, and therefore they require netilat yadayim because we're afraid they might come to touch the food. In the next Mishnah, Tzorel Adam Basar Gvina B'mit Pachad Achat, person can store meat and cheese in a single wrapping, Uvat Shelo Yenogim Zeh B'Zeh, as long as they don't touch each other. Ushim Gamlil Omer, Shneach Achsanayim, if you have two guests that are coming to a bed and breakfast, Ochlim HaShulchan Echad, they can eat on a single table, Zeh Basar V'Zeh Gvina. One of them can eat meat, and one of them can eat cheese, Vein Choshashim, and we don't worry about it. As the Gemara is going to say, and Rashi points out, because we're not worried about them taking from each other. They don't know each other. They don't have anything in common between them. And therefore, we're not worried about an exchange or one eating meat and milk and getting it mixed up. So now, b'chi, nogea, zeh b'zeh, my havi. Umar wants to know why when you store the meat and the cheese, can they not touch each other? Even if they touch each other, what's the issue? Tzonein b'tzoneinu. It's cold item to cold item, and that has no transference of flavor. If that's the case, there should be no problem even to store the milk and meat together. Zamrabayi, nehid klipa lo bayi, hadocha mi lo bayi. You're right. You don't have to peel off a layer of the item because there's no absorption when you have cold to cold. But nevertheless, if you have contact between cheese and basar, you have to rinse them off in order to ensure that there's nothing from the basar on the cheese and nothing from the cheese on the basar. And that's why we tell you not to store them together in a point where they're touching. If they're touching, then you're going to require to wash it off and you have to be careful about it. As long as you keep them separate, you're not going to have to worry about that. Yes, there's no transference in flavor to the depth of the items. You're not going to have to peel off a layer, but you still have to rinse them, and that's why we advise you not to store them touching each other. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Shnei Achsanayim Ochlim HaShulchan Echad. Amar Rav Chanan Bar Ami, Amar Shmuel, Lo Shanu Elo Shein Makirim Zed Zed. That's only if these two guests don't know each other or not familiar with each other. Aval Makirim Zed Zed Asur. But if they are familiar with each other, if they are friends, then it is problematic because we're going to assume that they would share food or they'd feel comfortable taking one from the other. And now it's a problem if you're eating milk and meat on the same table. Tanya Nami Ochi, we have a braita that's supportive of that understanding of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, because Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Bet Achsanayim, two guests, shenitarchu lepundak, that came to a bedak echad, that come to a single motel or bed and breakfast. Zeh ba min hatzafon, vezeh ba min hadrom. One of them coming from the north, one coming from the south. Zeh b'cha b'chatichato, vezeh ba b'kvinato. He comes with his piece of meat, and this one comes with their piece of cheese. Ochlim al shulchan echad. They can eat on a single table. Zeh batzar, this individual is meat, vezeh gvina, vein choshishin. And we don't worry about it. You see over here that he specifically says it's because one's coming from the north and one's coming from the south, meaning that they have no idea who the other person is. They have no familiarity with each other. And that's why we permit it. Velo asru. And the only time they made it asur is ele b'tfisa achat, when they are in a single bundle. Mar says, tfisa achat sal kadatcho. What does having to being in a single bundle have to do with anything? Forget about eating on a table and bundled together. It doesn't even matter if you're on the same shulchan. Even if you're not on a shulchan, you can't bundle the items together and eat them like that. You have to keep them separate. So what's the question of tfisa achat? It says, ke'en tfisa achat, that it's similar to being in a single bundle, which means that there is a free flow of food between the individuals because of their friendship or their commonality. And that's what would precipitate a problem. And that corroborates what we saw of the qualification of Rav Chanan bar Ami, Amar Shmuel, that qualified that statement of Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Tosfot over here speaks about what tfisa achat is. He says, based on the Gemara in Avodah Zarah that spoke about tfisa achat by Avnei Markulus, that means that it's something within the same horizon or same area. And the Gemara over there says, if there is something beni-beni, if there's a slight elevation between the two items, that's already considered to be not a tfisa achat. And Tosfot then for applies that over here and says that if there's yesh davar mafsik, if there's something that separates between the individuals, lo bikein tfisa achat, that's not like being in a single bundle. So even if they are familiar with each other, if there is something that separates between them, that is sufficient. And then he brings, v'fikach noagim achshav. So our practice today is, k'shezeh ochol basar v'zeh ochol gvina al shulchan achat, and they eat on a single table, menichim lechem o kankan, they put bread or a pitcher, ushar kelim, lafsik bentayim, or something else that sits between them, ochel al mapa acheret, or they eat on separate little table mats, davi ke'ein shtei tfisot, because that creates a separation or an indication that you're not in the same meal. So you have to give some sort of siman or indication that you're not in the same meal. It's preferable that you don't use an item that's going to be eaten during the meal. So for instance, if you have ketchup there that sits between them, and they one's eating milkshakes and one's eating fleishiks, and they're both going to use the ketchup, that somewhat defeats the purpose of having something in between. The item that sits in between should be something that stays throughout the meal. It's not going to be utilized by the parties, because otherwise, in a sense, it breaks down that barrier. So it has to be something that sits between that gives you a siman or an indication that you are separate. And placemats might be sufficient, according to the Baal Tosafot, to create that separation between them. He does bring another interpretation, which is tfisa achat, means that they had the same outlays, meaning that the items were purchased by a single outlay. And he says, like brothers who inherited an estate, and the estate's paying for the food of the brothers, since they're being paid by the same individual, that's when there's a problem. And that's what the Gemara says. Why does it matter if it was paid for by a single individual, or a single estate, or two different individuals? And the Gemara answers, k'ein tfisa achat, means that it's like that, meaning that when there's a single expenditure for both parties, it means the parties know each other, they're close to each other. And that's what it means, tfisa achat. But then the Baal Tosfot would say, if you explain tfisa achat in that way, then putting anything in between the two parties would do nothing for you, because it's not tfisa achat, meaning that they're in a single horizon or a single plane, like the first interpretation, which can be broken up by putting something in between. Over here, tfisa achat just means familiarity or commonality between them, and then putting something in between won't create that separation. So depending on how you explain tfisa achat, will also present you with the capacity to deal with that tfisa achat. According to the first explanation, putting barriers or simanim that indicate that you're separate is enough. According to the second interpretation, that would not suffice in order to allow you to eat together on the same table. So Amalei Rav Yemar Bar Shalmayo Le'abaye, Shnei Achim U'Makpidim Zeh Zeh Ma'u. You have two brothers, but they are makpid not to take from one another. Is that okay in order for them to eat together? And again, that would then maybe reinforce the second interpretation that Tosfot brought, that Tfisa Achad is speaking about a single outlay from a state where you have multiple brothers that are eating from the same outlay. And over here it's saying, okay, even if the two brothers come from the same estate, but they're makpid one on the other, what's the din? Amalei yomru kol asrikim asurim v'srike baitus mutarim. You're going to say that all the cakes or all the forms are problematic, but the srike baitus are okay. This is based on a Gemara in Psachim with regards to matzo, that the bakers who make matzo, They can't make designs or different shapes out of the matzot because we're afraid that you're going to tarry while doing that and it's going to turn into chametz. So we don't allow you to do it because of the time elapsed that will take place when you're forming these items. The Gemara over there says that baitus had a form, a pre-made form, which they stuck the dough into, which made the shape, and they would do it very quickly, and they didn't have this problem. So the Gemara over there says, if we're matir, that srikim of baitus, what are people going to say? Kol srikim asurim srike baitus mutarim? You're going to be permit this and not permit that. That makes it into a subjective type of concept. And we want to make a gzera that applies across the board, and we're going to tell people, don't make shapes. Because people aren't going to understand that, oh, those baitus are okay, these are not okay. They're not going to be able to differentiate or understand that distinction, and therefore we made it asur across the board. And similarly over here, if two brothers who normally eat together, it's problematic because they know each other, then even if they're makbid on each other, it's still going to be problematic, because just because these brothers are makbid, doesn't mean people are seeing this, or people are going to understand that there's a difference between these brothers and other brothers. A person only has one piece of clothing, whether it's on Chol HaMoed or whether it's during Aveilut, mutar lekabso b'chol shemoed. You're allowed to launder it on Chol HaMoed, or you're allowed to launder it during Aveilut or during the 9 days. Yomru kol asrikim asurim srikim baitus mutarim. Why don't you invoke the same principle over there? People aren't allowed to launder during those days, and now you're going to let this person launder because he has only one piece of clothing? So how are people going to know, or how are they going to tell the difference? You should invoke the same principle. How come over there it's mutar, and over here it shouldn't be mutar? The Gemara answers, Hatam ha'amar mar baravashi ezoro mochiach alav. Over there, there's some indication that makes it clear that he only has only one beged. And that is that a person has a belt, and the belt is something that they move from one beged to another beged. An individual who is multiple begadim, he will wash his beged and he'll move the belt to his other beged. An individual has only one beged, he has nowhere to move his belt. So he'll end up washing the beged and the belt together. So therefore, if you see the person wash their clothing with the belt on it, you know that it's his only piece of clothing that he has. And therefore, they'll know the reason it's permitted over here is because that's his only piece of clothing. If you don't, it's not your only piece of clothing, then you can't launder it. By the case of the Achim, how are you going to know whether they're makpid or not makpid on each other? It's not obvious. It's not something that is printed on them, and therefore you're not, if you permit them to do that, how are people going to differentiate? And the same is true with the srikim. Once they're made, the forms all look the same. We don't know if they were made by hand or they're made by a mold. Nobody's going to know that, and therefore they're not going to be able to distinguish, and they're going to come to make a mistake that srikim are allowed. And therefore we're going to oser srikim, even though there are some parties that do it through a mold and doesn't have that problem of a delay. So that's the difference in these cases. And therefore in cases where it's mukach, that the person is doing this in a different manner or a different way, then we'll permit it in differentiation from the halacha as a whole. But in cases where you can't differentiate, then the halacha applies in an objective manner, and that applies by the srikim, and as well as by the case here of separating or individuals who know each other not eating at the same table. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Kufchet Amud Aleph.